Welcome to Season 2. This is What Does It Profit? And I'm your host, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. For those who don't know us yet, let's be clear. We're a business show, but unlike others, we're not here to talk about business tactics, marketing, sales, investment, finance. We're not even really here to talk about the economic value of business. We're here to talk about profit, but profit in a wholly different way. Each week in this podcast, I'll talk to some of the leading thinkers and researchers, entrepreneurs and executives about value, the social and moral value of business. As these ideas feel all the more urgent as we as a planet face enormous challenges, climate change, pandemics, demands for social reform, many of these challenges brought about, some would argue, by capitalism. Each episode, each guest will bring me a little closer to finding out what does it profit. All right, I'll fess up. Last week, I turned 50. Yes, I came of age in the 80s with the iconic money movie Wall Street. You remember this, right?
Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit.
It just makes you want to go out and buy up the world. And who in my generation could forget Miami Vice? TV's attempt to portray the sordid free enterprise coming out of the drug trade. Greed and drugs, the cultural bookends of my formative years at the movies and in front of the television. And this, the beginnings of the formation of a business ethics podcast host. You know, this walk down memory lane is a setup for season two. We really wanted to start season two with a guest who had a compelling story and something really important to tell us about what's at the heart of our show. The idea that our work and all our actions not only have consequences, but also provide us with the opportunity to make profound change. Our guest's story is so interesting to me that we decided to stretch the length of our typical episode so that we wouldn't have to stop the conversation. Kicking off season two, let's talk to the 80s most notorious narco money man, George Valdez. And now let's welcome to What Does It Profit, George Valdez. George, welcome.
Nice to be with you, Dawn.
Well, I have to tell you, if there is anyone in this universe that represents in my mind the ideals behind the mantra of the show, What Does It Profit, George, it's your life.
Yeah, you know what? That's what really interested me about your show because, you know, a lot of times, a lot of especially shows that are not religious in nature, they are afraid to post anything. So like, I know that a lot of times I post on LinkedIn, a lot of different posts, and I use some of the scriptures as a backup to just ordinary things that happen in our lives every day. You know, what can we learn? And I tell people, instead of me using them as a Bible verse in any form of evangelization, I just simply look at it as a book of morals, right? So if I want to talk about gossiping, if I want to talk about integrity, honor, truth, I think that the scriptures have a lot to teach us as far as morality goes.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. Well, I just got a little scared when my interns told me that we ranked on the first page of Google with What Does It Profit? And I'm like, I think that earned me a few centuries in purgatory.
There you go. You'll be able to go just straight up, skip purgatory.
Well, I don't know. If we're bumping down God on Google, I think that may be frowned upon a little bit. I'm so glad you found us.
Yeah, no, it is. And it was exciting. And then, of course, I've been reading some of your things. And, you know, because ethics is so critical in our work, our faith. Forget it. Let's go back even. Not faith. Any person that wants to be a person of integrity, ethics is the way that, how do we behave in our entire life? And it's really interesting for me to see how some people will look at ethics in the workplace and be able to separate it from their personal life. And I just like, really, how does that work? Or if you are like, I am a Christian, I make no excuses for it. And at the same time, a lot of the people that I know and love are not. But the thing is, how can I be a Christian, what, in church or in X amount of hours or and not in the workplace? There's a big disconnect there.
Well, George, for most of your life, your workplace was pretty unconventional. Let's tell our listeners who you, how you spent most of your career, I guess you'd say. You're a pretty notorious fellow.
Well, you know, it's very, very interesting because even at that life that I'm going to tell you about, and this is something that I really, really struggle in today's world. Even in that life, it was a criminal life, but there were some of the most people of the highest integrity, people that you could live and die for on their word, people that you didn't need a contract to do $1 billion worth of business a month with. And then we jump to, I come out of that world and all of a sudden it's like, man, I need 5 contracts for 1 contract then. So, you know, my story, and I'll give you like the cliff notes, is very interesting because, and when you look at the life of a lot of people that are involved in drug trafficking, let's call them as a drug lord, as society would call you, or the head of a organized crime family, you think that they're most people that, you know, they've always been bad, and bad people are going to end up being bad, and bad people make bad decisions. But what makes my life very interesting or very different, and this is why I have struggled a lot with Hollywood, is because I left Cuba at the age of 10. My parents were very wealthy only because my mother was very devout Catholic. My mother was one of those that did not want us coming home from school, 8, 9, 10, and telling her that God did not exist, as was we were told in Cuba. And all of a sudden, at home, is God is everything. I mean, if you look at our town, the church was really the center of the town. So my mother decides she wants to leave Cuba, leave everything that we owned, everything that we had. You know, my father was a millionaire, which is saying in the United States might not be saying much, but in a country like Cuba, an island, was a lot in the 50s and 60s. To come to the United States with the clothes on our back and not have anything. The problem was that I say that I see my life in 3 cataclysmic moments. And so at the age of 10 at the airport, when suddenly we realized my mother is not coming with us, and my father, who never wanted to come because he didn't think that communism was going to affect him, and he was 40-year-old man, did not speak the language. So he's like, what am I going to do in the United States? We'll be fine here. And my dad, well, you know, he said he was Catholic, but, you know, typical of the 60s man or Hispanic man, you know, tremendous integrity, tremendous principles, you know, love God. But according to him, it was a very private thing between him and God. And he didn't have to pray, show us that he prayed or none of that, or even go to church. So my mother comes to me and says, take your brother and sister. Now I'm 10. My brother's 9. My sister's 5. And I'm in a daze, almost like I'm hypnotized, walking towards that airplane, obeying my mother like I did all my life till the day she died. And, you know, not knowing what's going on in my world. And then my dad came. And he came on the airplane when he saw that we were the last people to board and he was leaving us behind. So we came to Miami and we used to live in a house that was probably, I don't know, maybe 9,000 square feet, 7,000 in Cuba. And come to the United States to live in an 800 square foot apartment, maybe not even that, maybe 700, 1 bedroom, 1 bathroom, 11 of us.
Oh my gosh.
Sleeping in the floor where we had to write down what time we were going to take a pee because it was 11 people going to work or school and not having no money to eat. My dad came to clean toilets at Jackson Byron's, which is like a JCPenney's, as a janitor for 85 cents an hour, minimum wage. And, you know, we had nothing. And so that was the first moment when I decided God is not real. God doesn't exist. I don't want nothing to do with God. And I lived a very atheist life for many, many, many years. But still, no faith in God or anything like that. To me, was God was going to be me, whoever I made him out to be. But I was going to be nobody until I became somebody. And somebody to me was whenever I had those things that the rich and famous have, you know, the beautiful houses, the beautiful cars. And, you know, my dad was always like, work hard. Definitely always is, son, in life you have no control whether you're rich or poor. And I'm like, no kidding, right? I figured that out at 10, whether you're healthy or sick or dead or alive. The only thing in life you have control of is your word. And my dad was the type of man, I remember coming home from school one day and seeing a friend of mine who had just come from Cuba about 6 months before us. And I went to my dad and said, hey, Dad, I found out my friend, he has lunch. And he's, my dad just nodded his head. And I said, yeah, he told me that he gets, his family gets food stamps. And I said, Dad, have you heard about food stamps? And he's like, yes. He said, well, why don't we have food stamps? He says, because that's for poor people. And he says, and I'm like, holy cow, we haven't even gotten to poverty yet. We're like so way down there. And then he's like, son, poor people that get help from the government stay poor all their lives, and you figure out how to work, how to get up early, and help feed your family. I was 10. So that was the first cataclysmic moment in my life where I went from being a normal 10-year-old young man to all of a sudden being an adult.
Wow, so you had the motivations, but you know, you've got the smarts too. Where did that take you?
So I worked really, really hard, went to school, a complete nerd, never in my life drank any alcohol, never did drugs. I worked full-time. I was the youngest employee in the Federal Reserve Bank at the age of 17 in Miami office.
Now, George, I have to tell you, that is not the quintessential profile of a drug lord.
No, and then on top of that, so I worked full-time at the Federal Reserve Bank, and I went to University of Miami full-time and graduated top of my class. And then an accounting professor asked me to go work for him to do his Spanish clients. I did. One of them turns out to be a front for what eventually became known as a group that we know, the Medellin Drug Cartel. And literally, so my life, I began with these people just opening foreign bank accounts for them. I tell people, and this is really critical, I have very distinct lines that I would never cross. And I knew that I was going to, my plan was I graduate from Miami at 20. I work a couple of years to save enough money, go to law school, graduate from law school at 25, and be a millionaire by 30. That was my plan. And nothing was going to deviate me from that. And I was never going to cross any line that could eventually impede those plans. Well, I did when I went to work for these people and found out they were drug dealers. And it was a lot more complicated than the cliff notes that I'm giving you. But anyway, the long story is I started opening foreign bank accounts and then my world changed. You know, I tell people I used to make, I don't know, $2.20 an hour when minimum wage was 85 cents. And I mean, I was rich, but you know, I drove an old beat up Vega. I used to get paid twice a month. One salary went to my parents. The other one, I paid all my expenses. So when I went to work for them and found out, and they eventually told me they were drug dealers, I was like shocked, but for about 2 seconds, because I said, well, you're an accountant. You're here to count money. There was no money laundering laws then. Those laws were created to come after us. And they wanted me to open foreign bank accounts. I did. I started making a lot of money. They wanted me to open a shipping company to import bananas, which I thought that's really what they wanted to do, but it wasn't. And I was like doing well. And they constantly kept harassing me to handle all operations in the United States.
So you are in your early 20s, just out of school, you know, nerdy by your own description. And this is what you're doing.
And not only in my early 20s, at 20, I had just turned 20 years old. But I started making money. Not like what I would end up making 6 months later, but then my world, my second cataclysmic moment was, so all this time they're asking me, we want you to handle all operations in the United States for us. Now I was like, no, listen, I'm fine opening the foreign bank accounts. I'm fine with the shipping company, but that's where it goes. I mean, I had no idea what cocaine looked like or anything like that. And it's very, very important to know that we need to go back to 1976 when cocaine was not even in the DEA radar. So I went to a party and I saw a judge that used to give people tons of time for any drug offense, snorting cocaine in a very compromising situation. And I'm like, you know, there is no God at 10 and at 20, you know, there's no morals. So therefore, what does it matter? I ended up accepting, and then within 6 months, I was U.S. head of all operations for this group that became known as the Medellin Drug Cartel, and we were importing in 77. I just turned 21 by then. In 77, we were importing between 500 to 1,000 kilos a month, doing roughly $75 to $100 million a month, which at that time said that we made more money than General Motors did.
Well, so you got Pablo Escobar was the boss, right? So he's like...
Pablo Escobar had not even come into the scene yet.
Oh, I see. Well, I mean, you guys were like the Steve Jobs of the cocaine industry.
Well, this group, first of all, there was, and here's I've said this two or three times, but I'll repeat on your show. There was no Medellin drug cartel. Medellin drug cartel is a name the United States gave to a group of drug dealers in Colombia in the 80s that they could all tie them up together and have one common enemy. In 1976, the cocaine trade in America started with this group, and there were four of them, and I was the fifth. And from that group, which the head of that group was a gentleman named Manuel Garces, very devout Catholic, daily communicant, two sisters that were nuns, and unbelievable. He's still alive, by the way, the only one from that era that's still alive. From that group, 76, 77, 78, 79, 80, in the 80s is when Pablo Escobar comes on the scene. In 81, 82, then he becomes very notorious. By no means was he the most powerful. By no means was he the wealthiest. Really, the wealthiest drug barons or drug lords, people don't even know their names. But Pablo was the deadliest. If he had a beef with me, he would kill me and any male in my family. He only forgave wives and daughters, because to him, the children will one day grow up to become an adult and come after him. So very, very weird world.
You had a run-in with Pablo and it, you know, had your life in peril.
You know, it all began before this run-in. What happened is, so in 84, I went to prison late 79, and I still ran the cartel till about 80. Then it was taken over by the people that were my right hand. So in 84, when I came out of prison, the world had drastically changed. Now Pablo was a big shot and other people. So we went back. I got together with Manuel and we started importing a lot again. We're importing 1,000 kilos a month. Well, one of the things that I did, you know, I always believed in win-win, you know, in life. So like I tell people, every employee is going to take a bonus. The question is, do you give it to them or do they take it? So for me, when I was running the cartel, I said to myself, here I am paying my employees $5,000 a week for people that normally would make $100 a week. That was a lot of money. But then I said to myself, they're collecting $75 to $100 million for us. They know that I'm making between $1 and $3 million a month. When are they going to let that settle in their head? So then I decide, okay, at the end of the month, I do all the accounting. And however much money we made, I give 10% and I divide it among the employees. So it was really not that much more. I mean, it was significant, but not drastically more. But it changed the whole dynamic. Plus, they knew that if they got arrested, you know, I would buy a house for their wife. If they didn't want a house, I would pay all their kids' education. And I'd give her $3,000 to $5,000 a month until they got out. And they would be represented by the best lawyer in America. So the loyalty was enormous. But what I decided, okay, so if let's say I'm bringing in 600 kilos, and I would say to Manny, okay, 300 are ours, but let me divide the other 300 among the three other big drug lords in Colombia, you know, Pablo, Gasha, and another guy. So they would not be jealous that here I am importing all these drugs, because in reality, if I won, everybody win. But one day he comes up to me and I mean, this went on for about a year and a half. And he comes out to me and says, I want to start selling insurance. And I'm like, what, are you FedEx or UPS? Or what do you mean insurance? So I used to charge the people that those people that are bringing 300, I used to charge them between $5,000 and $7,000 a kilo. So if I charge them $5,000, they would tag on two more. And that's how they made some profit. They would do the same with other people. So he says to me, what I'm going to do is, in the next load, none of it is going to be mine. It's going to belong to different people that I know. And I'm going to tell them that if they pay $10,000 a kilo, they get insurance, which means that if something happens to the load, if it gets intercepted, if it gets busted, whatever, they would not lose it. They would just simply get the cocaine back in Colombia. So I really couldn't understand what was going on, but he explained it was real simple. It was what he considered a victimless crime. He said, look, at the end of the day, every third load, because I said it, Pablo, we never lost a load. He said, I understand, but every third load, I'm going to say that it got lost, because that's the average among other people. So once it gets lost, all I would do is replace the cocaine they gave me to bring to the U.S. in Colombia. So, for example, so at that time it was worth $2,000 to $3,000 a kilo in Colombia. It was selling for $20 in the U.S. So basically, all they lost is time, right? So they gave Pablo 20 kilos to come to America. 20 kilos were lost. Pablo gives him 20 kilos back. Where was the big profit? Well, all of a sudden, he has 100 kilos in the U.S. without putting up a dollar that he has for $2,000 that he paid the people back in Colombia. So he was making some significant amounts of money. So I looked at him and I'm like, you know it's not a victimless crime. I know it is a victimless crime, but it's a lie. And I just don't participate in that. Yeah, he could not understand, but he was sort of like happy because he was going to do it anyways. And he didn't have to cut me in.
There you are, the consciousness of cocaine.
Yeah, and so I'm like, look, you sell all the insurance you want. I couldn't care less. Then people don't know who I am. So he did. Well, a year and a half went by. And one day we bring in a load through Mexico. I was one of the first people to start bringing cocaine through Mexico because we couldn't bring none through the United States anymore. It had gotten very, very difficult. Some people started bringing to the Bahamas, but that to me was just too much risk and too much hassle and too many people involved. So I had a great connection in Mexico and we started bringing. But apparently where we were going to land, there was a operative. You know, the federal government was doing an operation there. So the pilot that came from Colombia with the cocaine said, hey, I have another airstrip. It's outside of Houston on the Mexican side and we can go there. Sure. And they went there, they loaded the cocaine and it was fine. Well, 3 months later, this guy that I had helped a lot, who has one of the most notorious assassins that they had in Colombia, I helped him in the sense of when his boss got killed, I took care of his boss's son. I protected him for about a year. Otherwise, he was going to get killed. So he owed me a lot. So he called me. He says, I really need to see you right now. It's very urgent. Well, one, for me, was very weird that he didn't come to my office because he had been there many times. So I met him at Daily Mall. And when we went in, I said, like, Victor, what's the matter? And he says, I have a contract on your life. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He said, yeah, I'm just as shocked as you are because I know you. You never, ever robbed anybody or lied to anybody. He said, Pablo says... And it was actually not even Pablo. It was actually Pablo's cousin who didn't like me very, very much. But, you know, Pablo was the word that everybody used. So he said, Pablo says that you disrespected him, that that airstrip you guys used when you came from Mexico outside of Houston was his, and you used it without his permission. And I'm like, let's get him on the phone. Number one, I had no clue that it was his. Number two, I didn't even know they went to another airstrip. And number three, he knows that if I had known that it was his and I needed, I simply ask because he's used many of mine. So we called him and I told him exactly that. I said, first and foremost, I'm really surprised you wouldn't call me and ask me. He said, well, it was my cousin. I said, that's fine. I said, but the contract is in your name. And I said, second of all, you know that if I had known that it was your airstrip, I would have asked you. You would have given it to me, as I'm sure, like many times that I've given you mine. And number three, you know I don't lie. So what do you want to do? I'm here. I don't hide from people. I don't hide because someone's a killer or not. I believe in facing people face to face. And he says, if that's what happened, I believe you. And he hung up and thing was done. So a simple thing like, you know, not participating with someone in a lie ends up saving my life and the life of my children, right? Because he would have had all the boys. At that time, I had two boys. He would have had them killed.
George, this sounds like a cross between Scarface and Miami Vice.
Well, Miami Vice was really during our times. You know, there was a joke going on at certain clubs where Dan Johnson would frequent that, hey, the people here, the real Miami Vice. So, and I mean, a lot of the stuff in Miami Vice was taken from what was going on in Miami during that period. You know, a little more Hollywood nice, Hollywood dice. I don't know how you would even say that, but yeah, it was a very difficult time. Actually, the sad part about it was that it was the most, and recently found this out, that period was actually, Miami was considered the most dangerous city in the world. Well, we were thousands in the cartel, and there's less than a handful of us alive. So it serves that even in that world. And this is the interesting thing. Like I tell people, I mean, do people know what you're going to do no matter what happens in your life? You know, do people know what you will not do when you say you won't do it? Is your work good? I mean, is truth matters, especially in today's world where truth doesn't seem to matter to anybody? I feel like I'm a dinosaur in a sense, you know, because people just lie like it's water.
Oh, yeah. Fake news.
Yeah, exactly. Everything is fake news now.
Yeah. Well, tell us, you mentioned you spent 5 years in jail in the end of the 70s, early part of the 80s, and then you're back in business. And then what happened? How much longer did you stay in? And then how did you get out?
So what happened in 79, I worked out a deal with the government of Bolivia. I got on an airplane that I've never gotten into before because coming to the United States, I would just let the people, the pilots, and always an escort come. But I had a meeting with Somoza in Nicaragua. So I got on the airplane thinking I'd get off in Nicaragua and then I would fly home in one of my jets. But we crashed over the jungles of Panama. I paid off the attorney general. One of the pilots that was with me ratted us out. He ends up telling Noriega that I had bribed the attorney general of Panama. I was tortured for 30 days to a point where I bled for 5 years every time I went to the bathroom. I got released, sent to Miami, charged with heading the largest drug conspiracy in the history of America, given the highest bond ever in history. Started at $7 million. They ended up at $2 million when a $10,000 bond was a huge bond back then. And that's when I went to prison for 5 years. So I got out. I went back to the same thing that I was doing before. But then my mother and father did not know what I was involved with prior to me being arrested.
How did they not know? I understand. And you led a pretty lavish lifestyle. What did they think was going on?
They thought I was a legitimate millionaire. And I'll tell you, there's going to be a major release in January. I can't say the streaming service, but it's going to be an original. And in it is revolving around our lives. And in it, they asked me a question that no one ever asked me. And I've done, I don't know, 500 interviews. The question was, why was it so difficult for Pablo Escobar or El Chapo, and they mentioned a couple other names. They had as much money as you did, as many airplanes as you did, as many fake passports as you did. Why wouldn't they go? Well, first of all, why wouldn't they ever get out of the business, number one? And number two, why wouldn't they go to a foreign country where there's no extradition? And yet it was so easy for you to get out. I said it was easy for me because I never saw myself as a drug dealer. My identity was I was a businessman. And because I was a businessman, I had a lot of different businesses. So my parents thought exactly that. I mean, I had one of the largest Brahman cattle operations in America. We had a shipping company. We had airplanes, an airline, a small airliner in Miami, big construction company. So I owned a lot of business and I traveled a lot. And that's what they thought. So I said, for me, it was easy because when I realized that business cocaine now, that was a victimless business back when I started, where our clients were the high society of America, the rich and famous, the people everybody wants to be like. When I realized that now it wasn't anymore, that now crack cocaine had come on board, now it had become very violent. Now you had to carry a gun and 10 bodyguards wherever you went. I said, it was easy for me to leave. Because I was still making millions legitimate. But my parents, so they didn't know, but of course they knew that I was brought from Panama in handcuffs and faced trial in Miami, and it was, you know, all over the newspaper. So now my mother starts telling me every single time, son, what you're doing doesn't please God. And to me, I mean, my respect for my mother was so, you know, for my parents. I tell this to people, and my bodyguard used to get a kick out of something that happened all the time is, you know, my dad and I used to love to watch movies. And sometimes we'd sit there and the movie over and my dad looked at the watch and it was, let's say it was 10 o'clock. He says, hey, son, do you have a big day ahead of you tomorrow? I said, yeah, dad, I got a lot of things to do. And he says, well, I think you need to go to bed. And I would go to bed. So here I was considered one of the most powerful people in America. You know, 10 bodyguards, president will bow to me. And my father is sending me to bed like a little kid.
10 o'clock at night, yeah.
Now, people say, did you fear your father? I said, of course I did. Did I fear him hitting me? No, I had no fear about dying or anything. What I feared was letting down the man I loved the most. So I obeyed. And my mother was the same. No matter what she did to me, it was like she was my mother. I never disrespected her. So when all of a sudden my mom keeps saying, God and God and God and God. And then until one day I get a call in the middle of the night from my bodyguards. And this is during the time when they were kidnapping a lot of people in Miami. And I get a call and they're like, you got to come here. And so this is 2 o'clock in the morning. When I get a call, you got to come here to my parents' house. You can imagine what's going through my head, right? The worst of the worst. So we invaded my mom's house. I mean, it was like 10 cars, maybe 20 men with machine guns. Had there been police officers, I hated to see what would have happened then. And what had happened was that my mother had a Saint Barbara, and she was very, very devout of the Virgin Santa Barbara. So she had a statue of Santa Barbara outside the house. And my mother had an enormous prayer life. But for whatever reason this day, she decides about 1 o'clock in the morning, she wants to go out and pray to her Virgin like she did every time before she went to bed. So now I got all these bodyguards protecting my mother's house. And so the head goes up to her and he's like, Mrs. Valdez, it's very, very dangerous. Why don't you go inside? We'll bring Santa Barbara inside. You can pray. And then we'll bring Santa Barbara back out. And my mother, who was 4'11", because I tell people she was 5'4", she would have been worse terrorist than Osama bin Laden. And she somehow went in the house, got a gallon of paint, and just spread it all over his car. Literally all over his car. And then just kneeled in front of the Virgin to pray. So when I got to the house, she was in bed praying. I'm like, Mom, what is wrong with you? Don't you realize that what you're doing is going to get you killed, or it's going to get me to kill a lot of people? And she could say, Son, well, you know that what you're doing doesn't please God. And son, if I die, you kill me. And I'm like,
wow.
So, I got so irate. I'm saying, Mom, what God? There is no freaking God in this world. Where was God when we came from Cuba and we were literally going hungry? Where was God when you caught cancer? Where is God when all these horrible things happen around the world? There is no God. You want a God, Mom? I am God. I have the power to give and take life. I can have anything in the world. I can do whatever God can do. And literally, you know what's sad is that I really believe that. And not because I looked in the mirror and said, wow, George, you're so good looking that God must look like you. It was that everybody made me feel like I was God, like we do with celebrities, like we do with athletes. And it just works into your psyche. So my mom kept up with that. But my mom, and this is really, really important for parents. I tell people my mom was the best in tough love. So my mom would tell me all this. And she would like, son, if you go back to prison, you would kill, might as well bury your dad and I. And my mom, the minute she gave me hell about what I was doing or thought that she thought that I was still doing, then she would say, what do you want to eat tonight? Well, what food do you want me to make for you? Do you want your favorite dessert? So I tell people what's important about that is that she never wavered in telling me that what I did was wrong. She never took a dollar from me. She never accepted. She lived and died in the same house they bought with the money they worked in American factories. Same thing with her car, with my father's car. So they constantly lived their life without ever taking a penny. But at the same time, you know, showing me that she was my mother and nothing would ever change that. So when I got lost, which I did, I knew where to find true north. Whereas those people, oh, you're a criminal, get out of the house, I never want to see you again. It's the wrong approach, even with kids when they do wrong, you know?
Well, let that be a lesson to all the listeners out there who are parents. Sounds like St. Monica, you know, who prayed endlessly for St. Augustine, who later became a doctor of the church. So mom's giving you the tough love. What happens next?
So then, you know, then it starts dawning on me that, you know what, this is not the world that I am used to or that I, you know, got involved with. Now things are different. And because they're different, you know, I don't find any joy anymore. And now, think about this. I'm making $1 million, at least $1 million every month. And all I was doing, I wasn't around cocaine. I didn't see it. I didn't distribute it. All I did during this period of time is that I would give the go-ahead for an airplane to come or not. And I still paid all the high government officials that were in our payroll that I only knew, or the big bankers, you know, the minister of finance of this country, that country. And I just couldn't take it. So a friend of mine that used to be involved years earlier in the marijuana business, he would come over to the ranch. I was living in my ranch at this time, and I had the best quarter horse in the world, and a lot of people would breed to him. And I used to ask, hey, Lazaro, how did you get out? Now, he was in a much, much smaller level than I was. And he's like, George, you know, like being pregnant. You're either pregnant or you're not. You're either going to get out or you're not. And it kept in the back of my head. And then one thing led to another. One of my right-hand men got killed. I was supposed to go on that trip with him. I didn't. And he got murdered. And then at the funeral, I had baptized his daughter, like many, many godchildren that I had. And she was about a year older maybe than my daughter. And she kept saying to me, Padrino, Godfather, my daddy went to be with Jesus. And it was the first time I shed a tear from the day I left Cuba. I got to Miami at 10. I never shed another tear until that day. Because I said to myself, number one, if there is a God, we're definitely going there. But number two is, when will my little daughter be telling that to someone and I would never see her again? So that was like really, really prevalent in my mind. And then finally, one day, I was partying with some Hollywood celebrities. And in the middle of the night, my ex-wife dropped off my daughter at the ranch. And so the security, when they called me, they're like, your daughter's here. And I was like, what? So they brought her to the house, and I called the maid. I lived at this time. It was, I don't know, 9,000-10,000 square foot house. And I told the maid, look, take her to her room. And in the morning, when she gets up, I'll be up, and I'll eat breakfast with her. And somehow, she got out of her room and got to my room. And, you know, back then, I would have given anyone $1 million if they could actually get that close to my bedroom door. How or what happened, I have no clue, except I know it was a God thing in my mind. But she started knocking. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning. And it's like, Daddy, it's Crystal. And it was the first time in my life that I just felt filthy. I felt corrupt. I chased everyone out the window. I went into the bathroom, and I was trying to scrub the filth off of me. I went into my bed and got underneath my cover, and I started to have chills. Now, so I did, during this time, or prior to the time, I'm the guy that the DA considered and made public that ice ran through my veins. So here I am, I mean, just in tremendous chills. And what was going through my mind is, here's the only thing that's left in my life that is pure and is holy. And it's my daughter. And I can't open that door because I'm going to corrupt her. And it's almost like if you can visualize yourself in a boat and your child falls off, and you touch her fingertips as she's drowning, and there's nothing that you can do. So when I felt that she had quit crying, and I decided to go into the room outside to get some water, I found her by the floor crying. And that day, I made the decision. I said, I got to change my life. This is it. Today, this world is over for me. Now, very interesting. Because one of the messages that I tell people, that I try to take across, is that we're not defined by our past. That there is redemption, that there is hope, and that we can change. The question is, do we want to and how bad? So for me, when people say, well, what did you do different? I said, you know, the only thing about it, I had no idea what change would be. All I knew in my mind was that if I'm going north, I'm going to start going south. If I'm going east, I'm going to go west. I'm not going to go back to Miami where I'm this God and where I thought that the sun would rise and fall, and I'm just going to move away. And at the same time, my desperation to change was so much that I thought I had roughly less than a month to live. And what I mean by that, I thought that's how long it would take for them to come and get me and kill me. Reason being, number one, in the cartel, we didn't have a very good retirement program. So that's number one. Number two is, one of the things that they could not deal with was with the uncertainty. So they could deal with someone say, hey, I'm going to tell the government your name and that name and that name, because they couldn't care less about that. The government knew who they were, and their mission was, well, we'll make sure that you don't get on the stand and point your finger at us because the dead can talk. But when a guy like George Valdez, so high up, with never had a wiretap on me, never had a compromising photo of me, there was no operations going on against me, nothing. It was all like, and I'm making all this money for doing nothing. And they're like, why? Why? When they couldn't answer that why, then the logical thing would be just take them out. You know, so if we cannot identify the why and live with the why, then we'll just eliminate that doubt. And I knew that in my mind that that's how it worked.
That's got to be tiring and so much anxiety. All right, how'd you end up in prison?
So, number one, I couldn't spend $5,000 a week on bodyguards anymore because I wasn't making $1 million, $2 million a month. And so I hired this guy to come teach me karate. I had always done karate as a young man. And I always been an athlete. I played baseball in my younger age. And so when he came, and here's another interesting story. I was just talking to him not too long ago. The number that I was looking at the phone book to call was not the number that I dialed. But I ended up dialing this guy. And he was willing to drive an hour and a half from the closest town, big city to us, and to teach me karate for 2 hours. I was paying him an enormous amount of money. And the first day he came, he's like, I'm going to teach you about the sword. And I'm like, man, that's so awesome. I picked the guy that loves weapons. I love weapons. But we're not going to waste time with basics. And he turns around with a Bible. And I was so angry and irate. I looked at him and said, man, number one, I don't believe in that book. Number two, I don't believe what that book talks about. And number three, I'm paying you a lot of money to teach me karate. So tomorrow, you just leave that stupid sword home and bring a real sword.
So this is the guy that came to your house after you dialed a wrong number?
Yeah, this was the karate instructor that was not, because I had taken Okinawan karate as a young man, and that's what I was dialing, or I thought I was dialing, but I ended up dialing the other karate studio that was a guy that was Japanese.
So you're thinking you're going to learn, practice martial arts for self-protection, for stress relief, you know?
No, just for exercise, because I loved it. So, yeah, listen, martial arts is not that good against a machine gun. Trust me, it doesn't quite work that good. So anyway, he came and he was the first man that got within inches of my face and said, young man, what I got to give you, you got no money to pay. And I'm like, I don't have a gun with me. I don't have my bodyguards with me. This guy's 7th degree black belt. He's going to start introducing Jesus into me through kicks and I'm going to pay for it. I'm like, dude, don't get excited. Settle down. When we finish the lesson and we heat up the steam room, then talk to me. Waste your time. And he did this for 3.5 years every day. And I went from worse to worse. So what ends up happening, people say, well, what did he say that changed your life? I said, really nothing, because I was just getting over all the butt kicking he was giving me to even think about what he was saying. But I said, what was critical was everything that he did. So I saw this man in this very little world. You know, to me, his house was, I don't know, 800 square feet. To me, that was a tent. You know, I lived in this mansion. He drove an old car. I had $1 million worth of cars. And he told me he was so madly in love with this woman that was in her mid-40s. They've been married for 25 years. And I thought, like, that's really crazy. I'm surrounded by supermodels, and I can't stand any of them. What is wrong with this guy? And I would ask him, I said, why are you so joyful? You got nothing to be joyful about. Or so I thought, you know? Because to me, today, I believe the wealthiest is not the one that has the most, is the one that needs the least. So he's like, I have an intimate relationship with Jesus. And I'm like, what? Yeah, he says, I had this very intimate relationship with this God named Jesus. And that was so weird because I'm like, I'm surrounded by people that would die for me. I have no really intimate relationship with anybody. But it's everything I saw this man, the joy that he had for three years. And no matter what I did to him to provoke him, to tell me you're a devil, you're going to hell, he never did. He just kept steady. And I remember it was July 1st, 1990. And my divorce was finally final from my ex-wife. And it was about, I say about 9 o'clock in the morning, and she's dragging my little daughter off, and I see my little daughter crying. And I remember going into my room, I don't know, maybe it was 11 o'clock, but I remember the prayer just like today. I said, Jesus, first of all, I want to tell you, I don't think you're real. I don't think you exist. Number two, I want you to know that if you are real and you do exist, you're probably looking at me and say, George, you're so bad, I don't want you up here. I said, but number three, if you are the real reason why that man has that joy, I want it. And I'm willing to die for you. Or kill me if you're not. People say that when a sinner converts, there's angels in heaven playing music. Maybe they do, but I don't think for Cubans they do, because I didn't hear nothing. My world, actually.
I was going to like break into Guantanamera.
Yeah, my world, Don, actually went from bad to horrifically worst. 3 months later, I get arrested. I have no clue why. I've been out of the cartel for almost 4 years now. And I didn't know, had no idea. So they take me to Mobile, Alabama, where I had never been in my life. And my attorney's waiting there for me. And when he's waiting for me, he's like, I got great news for you. You're going to walk. I'm like, what are you talking about? He said, the government has one witness against you. And that witness made up a story. He says, he killed himself last night. While he was a government witness, he was still smuggling drugs in a DEA airplane. And he crashed in the fog, bringing in a load, and killed himself. So we're going to go in there and tell him you're innocent, and I'll get you out of here in no time at all. I looked at him, and I'm like, Alan, here you are, a good Jewish guy that I know, telling me I'm going home. But you know, I've committed my life to this other Jew that ain't telling me anything. But the truth of the matter is, if God does not change me, I don't care what happens to me, because I can't go on living the way I live. I can be fighting these people all my life, and I'm not going to go in there and lie, no matter what. He says, but if you don't, you're going to die in jail. I'm like, you know, if that's what it takes, that's what it takes. So we went into the U.S. Attorney's office, and virtually what they wanted was, actually, you probably know who the U.S. Attorney was. It was
Mr. Sessions. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And actually, you know, with me, he was just a great guy. So I need to say that, as much bad as people talk about him. And I'm sure he might not have been as good with a lot of people, but he was honorable with me. And basically what they wanted was my money. The day I retire, and I retire a multimillionaire, they couldn't stand it. So there was a big task force made out of DEA, Customs, FBI, and IRS. And also during a period where forfeitures gave the attorney general a lot of credit.
You probably made Jeff Sessions' career.
So actually, I think that I made him a senator. So I went in there. They're like, we're going to make it real simple. Lots of money, little time. Little money, lots of time. Now, when I retired in 87, beginning of 87, literally the most they could give me was 15-year sentence for a conspiracy, right? I didn't get caught with anything. Basically, someone said I did something, and the jury either believes him or me. But in December of that year, November, the minimum mandatory laws that you hear about now came into effect, which meant that 15 years, had I done it in December, would have been 3 life sentences. So what ends up happening, though, is that because they also had this law called RICO, Racketeering and Influence Corrupt Organization, it meant that even though I had walked away 3.5 years earlier, the guy that was bringing loads for me in 85, and 86, he was the guy that was busted, indicted, and he was given a life sentence. So he kept going with the enterprise. So now I am just as liable as him, even though I have been working with him, you know, for 5 years. Mm. So, yeah, that's why we need so drastic criminal reform and prison reform, because the laws are really not. Well, anyway, that's another topic for another day.
Okay, so did you write a big check and serve a shorter term or
So we went in there. They opened the door, and I said, how much money do you all think I have? And the assistant U.S. attorney there, she said, I don't know, but I know who does. They opened the door and come in these agents, and literally they knew how much toilet paper I consumed.
Wow.
So they're like, we want it all. Now, they couldn't take it because statute of limitations had run out on that. So my attorney said, look, he looks at me, we go outside, and he says, what do you want to do? I said, they can have it. I just don't care, man. And I just got to start. I said, that money will never bring me peace. I made that money illegally and at the pain of a lot of people's lives, even though I didn't think so at that time, but I see now. So he goes in there. He said, look, give him 10 years. The most you should give him is when he committed those crimes, the most was 15 years. But you didn't catch him with anything. He's going to confess to committing them. So technically, what you really can get him for is violation of parole. See, I had 10 years left of parole from my first sentence. And he'll give you everything, and he'll plead guilty right now. So Jeff Sessions then said, look, we can't promise anything because it's up to the judge, but we can make that recommendation. And that they knew that I had walked away on my own. And here I am. They knew that I could beat him, and I'm not willing to beat him. And second of all, they needed the money more than they needed the conviction. So I went in there. The judge said he rejected any agreement I reached with the government now or ever. He wanted to sentence, it was his intention to sentence me to a life sentence. And I looked at him and said, Your Honor, you can only give me what God can give me. And if God doesn't change me, I don't care where I die. Prison doesn't affect me. So I've been walking around dead anyways. Long story, I ended up getting 10 years. I served another 5. And then in prison, I just wanted to find out about this God. See, when I gave my life to God, I didn't believe in God, you know, but I had questions now. So I tell people, look, it's like people say, well, how can you believe in something you don't see? I said, well, it's like air. I can't see the air that goes in my lungs, but I know it's there. So I just started reading the Bible on and on and on constantly, day and night. And then I got another bachelor's in theology. Then I started my master's from Wheaton College. When I was released, I went to Wheaton and finished my master's. Then I was accepted to Loyola to do a PhD in New Testament and Ethics. So I was one of 5 Hispanics when I graduated with a PhD in Bible, not even to say probably the only one with a title of a convicted drug lord. And then I realized I couldn't put my kids through college with 6 kids with a teaching degree. And then my dad died. I was convicted what type of life I was going to have with my children. So I left my teaching and I moved to Georgia. And then I started a company from scratch with my wife and I, and I built it into a multi-million dollar national, international company. And then one day I sat there and I'm like, you know, when enough is enough. And I retired and spent the last, I don't know, I retired in 2010. So to spend the last 10 years just being a father to my last 2 kids that didn't know me. And by God's grace, all my kids now, they all have graduate degrees. They all are very successful. And then for my hobby, I call it a hobby, but I work harder now than I work ever before. You know, I spend my life doing the podcast, and I do some YouTube videos, and I used to speak a lot publicly, but now with COVID, that went away. So at the end of the day, is like what I tell people. I said, look, when the pages of history are written, will history ever remember your name? And maybe that's not important to a lot of people, but for whatever reason, it was important to me. And I believe that the only way that history remembers your name is not because you build a multi-million dollar company. I mean, if you tell my kids about the Vanderbilts, about all those barons that built America, they have no idea who they were. But you tell them about Mother Teresa, and they know. So at the end of the day, I believe that history remembers the name of those who impact somebody else's life. So when people ask me, what you're doing now, are you doing it so that you can make up for? I said, look, there's nothing on this God's earth that I can do to make up for the wrong that I did. And yeah, I spent 10 years in jail. I was tortured in a foreign prison where I bled for 5 years every time I peed. But you know what? Truth of the matter is, most likely, I should have been killed 3 times over to pay for the wrong that I did. But somehow God had mercy. So what I do is not to make up for the wrong. We never make up for the wrong we do. But I'm not defined by the wrong. I'm defined by who I am today. And so my mission, one of the things I do, we send books to prison. We send 40,000 this year. Our goal is to send, you know, 1 million in the next 10 years, just so that if nothing else, we give people hope that we're living in a world right now, especially with this pandemic, especially with the political climate that we've come from. People don't have any hope anymore. People don't know what to believe. And, you know, and I think that people change when they see that somebody else has changed. So what is my mission? You know, I tell people, look, I don't care who you are. I don't care what your sexual orientation is. I don't care what your religion or no religion is. I don't care to evangelize you. I don't care to convert you. I can't convert you because I didn't die for you, nor would I. So I can't save you. All I care about doing is just sharing how the love of a Jewish carpenter transformed the most hardened of all hearts. That's it. And then I said, well, if the shoe fits, wear it. If not, just, you know, go buy another pair.
All right, George, I have to ask the quintessential What Does It Profit podcast question. Your project, the Narco Mindset. So listeners, if you're out looking for a good podcast, check out George's podcast, the Narco Mindset. What does it profit? What does it benefit?
You know, many people, Don, they spend their whole life trying to climb this mountain thinking, let's call it the American dream, right? Not the old American dream of the world's greatest generation, very different than ours. The one that we believe now that the more you have, the happier you become. So they spend their whole life climbing that ladder. They abandon their marriages. They abandon their children. They do things that are inconceivable in that search to find that meaning. And unfortunately, very few will get there. And the few that get there realize there's nothing there. There's nothing there. Because at the end of the day, great joy doesn't come from 10 cars. Listen, and I love cars. I love jets. I love a lot of the material things everybody else loves. But when people ask me, do you miss your old life? I said, of course. I mean, who wouldn't miss? Especially when I have to travel coach now. Who would not miss walking up to my jet? One of four jets. But the thing about it is that life was empty. It was full of nothing. And it had tremendous consequences. And it brought me no joy. The greatest joy in my life was when we came from Cuba and had nothing, but we had a family. You know, my brother sent me a song. If you know that song, Neil Sedaka, The Hungry Years. So he sort of readapted. He said, you know, you climbed the ladder that led you to nowhere. Everything you wanted was everything you had. But look at now how you miss the hungry years when we had nothing, but we had each other. And when you have a family, and if we can learn to find joy in the most minute of things, not in what the world has to offer, because that's nothing. You know, why do people have so much money, keep making more and more money? This isn't because of the money. I mean, how many jets could I fly in? How many million-dollar cars could I drive? How many mansions could I live in? It was just that quest, because I believe, at the end of the day, we all come into this world with an emptiness inside of us, okay? An emptiness that we believe that society tells us, right? Just watch the commercials. When you have this, I mean, look at this. When you have this, look at the gorgeous women you're going to have. Or when you live in this beautiful house or this car, on and on and on. When you have half, you will fill that hole. But it doesn't. To me, and I need to clarify that, I was only able to fill that hole when I entered into a relationship with that Jewish carpenter. When I ended realizing that my greatest joy is not in winning. See, especially in today, this is a very important message today. Half of America hates the other half of America today. Why? Because both sides are just, I mean, they're just so desperate to win. Because we live in a world that even we don't teach little kids anymore that we, in Little League, that one wins and one loses. No, everybody wins now. And that's wrong. See, for me that I believe in Jesus, I believe he didn't come to win. He came to lose so that I could win. And today, when I lose so that somebody else can win, that's where I find my joy. I find my joy in giving, not in taking. We created a foundation. We gave from the beginning 10% of our growth. That's a lot of money in the company. We were making millions. And, you know, and when you have a company that big, 10% becomes probably the biggest line item in your entire budget. But we didn't care because we knew how to live with the rest and we knew how to find. But the joy that we found when we built the only Catholic chapel inside a United States prison with this man never going to go home. And when I go there every year for the last 22 years and someone comes up to me and says, you know, I'm sentenced to life. I'm never going to go home. I've been here maybe 35 years. For the first time sitting in this chapel, I found happiness and joy in my life. That gives me joy when I see that somebody else wins. So if we quit wanting to win so bad, and if we quit wanting to put our faith and our hope in a political candidate, at the end of the day, I believed this real simple. None of them, I don't care who goes to the White House. None of them ever done anything for me, and none of them will ever do anything for me. So how can I put my faith in, how can I hate people that are my friends, that are my family? When at the end of the day, is what the world has gotten us to, the division. We're not Republicans or Democrats, we're Americans. And you know, it's the greatest country in the world. It's only the greatest country when its people are good, you know? Not because we have all this great thing, not when its people are good, and Americans are good. We see it doing tragedy like 9-1-1. We see it doing hurricanes. People come out and risk their lives to say something. We see it right now, this pandemic, with first responders exposing their lives and sacrificing their lives. They're not getting paid extra, you know? This is when we're good. And so when we find our joy in letting someone else win, and we stop wanting to win at all costs, and we start believing in all this crap about all this conspiracies going on in the world to defeat me, it's not about us, man. Just find our joy in us. Because like you said, what does it matter? What do you gain? If at the end of the day, you're going to lose your soul. And we do.
That's
or
right.
At the end of the day, you lose your family. And that's how you lose your soul, right? To me, part of losing my soul was losing my family and my kids. So what matter all the money in the world? At the end of the day, it's like this story I tell when I speak all the time. I said, there was a real rich man. He looks down through his high-rise penthouse, and he sees a beggar. And he says, thank God I'm not poor. The beggar all of a sudden sees an ambulance going by and says, thank God I'm not sick. The sick in the hospital sees a man in a stretcher covered, and he says, thank God I'm not dead. So every single one of them were able to thank God except the dead man. The dead man can't thank God, can't thank anybody. We're only here temporarily. It's crazy how we just are so cling on to this world, this life, like it's eternal. You know, I tell people, listen, we see people sacrifice everything. For what? 80, 90 years? Man, I'm 60. I was 23 when I lived, 20 to 30 when I lived in that world. What does it matter? We got, you know, X amount of time. But where's our soul? Why would we lose in the meantime?
Well, George, my brother, I thank you. And I thank you so much for sharing your story. I know I am certainly looking forward to it. And I know our listeners will really enjoy even more in-depth this story when it comes out on the streaming service, not to be mentioned here on the What Does It Profit podcast. But you've got books and other resources, and we'll make sure we put all of that in the show notes so our listeners can find us. But George, thank you so much for sharing with us today. I wish we had more time.
Thank you so much, Don, for what you're doing. And it really is critical, you know, what you're doing, because it is important that we bring ethics back into our workplace and to realize that, hey, let's find meaning in the small thing. People go to my website and they sign on to our community. They get a free copy of my book. At the end of the day, you know, our soul is worth a lot more than any richness the world has to give, because it's only temporal.
Amen. Amen. You cannot take it with you.
You've been listening to What Does It Profit? And thanks to all of those who've gotten the word out about the show, especially our friends at CastBox. Check us out there and see our cool new show art. You can meet our team and sign up for our weekly newsletter at our website, whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. In our next episode, we're going to a difficult place. We're going to have a conversation with the leading authority in negotiating the value of a human life. He was a special master of the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund. His wisdom has mediated the compensation for many of the most horrific tragedies and torts of the last 60 years.
I do it because I'd like to think that I'm giving something back to America and to my fellow citizens. I'm also, I think, trying to alleviate, if I can, at least one obvious stress point for victims: financial insecurity. If I can at least give victims one less thing to worry about by providing them some financial stability, I think I'm doing something good.
Next on What Does It Profit? Ken Feinberg. In the meantime, follow us on social media to keep up with the show and to help us build the What Does It Profit community. You can also rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts and tell your friends about the show. We'd love to hear from you. In fact, let us know your thoughts on the importance of exploring the moral and social value of business. Email a brief audio file to our production team at producer@whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. What Does It Profit is written and hosted by me, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. This episode was produced by guest producer Lucy Wang. Special thanks to our talented interns, Niels, Hannah, and Sean, other team members, and our long and illustrious group of friends and supporters can be found on our website, whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. Before I let you go, let me remind you to never stop asking yourself, what does it profit?